Hello. I have absolutely no idea how I'm going to start this podcast. So I'll just start by saying that my name is Christian Corley. His name is James McLean. And you are listening to Casterbrus. James, just last night, actually, I was watching an episode of Midsummer Murders. I don't think you're a fan of Midsummer Murders, are you?
I'm resistant to being led, and for those who have not followed us talk for the last decade, you have long time been a fan of that show, and I can't get into it because I kind of feel like I'd be led by you, so I'm afraid not. I see there's different iterations on, I think, ITVX, isn't it?
Which
has got the... So it's been a very popular show.
But it has, yeah.
I know nothing about it.
Well, it started in 1997 with a pilot episode with the cast that, you know, was with the show for the following 6 or 7 years, John Nettles and Daniel Casey. But the interesting thing is, then it was so popular, and it was an adaptation of a book by Caroline Graham. They then decided to commission a series, and the first episode proper of Midsummer Murders was the one that we watched, the one we were watching, the name of which escapes me right now. It might be written in blood. I'll check it in a minute. But the reason I bring this up is because one of the guest actors, and it had a superb guest cast, which includes Anna Massey and a guy whose name escapes me at the moment, but particularly David Troughton, who long-running listeners of this podcast will know from his connection to Doctor Who, both as a character, an actor in Doctor Who, as the relation of one of the actors who played Doctor Who, and also also has later worked with Big Finish, doesn't he? And, of course, he was in Doctor Who in 2008, in Midnight. So, and he plays such a horrible, sleazy, judgmental, snobby drama teacher. He almost steals the episode. If it wasn't for Anna Massey playing it absolutely insane towards the end, David Troughton would absolutely have stolen the episode, just for the sheer unpleasantness of his character. Whenever you watch David Troughton, you can see a bit of Patrick Troughton in there, but he's obviously clearly his own very good actor. And I wonder if he's maybe a little bit underrated anyway.
Probably lives a little bit in the shadow of his father, just from some of the roles that he has taken. I don't know, that sounds almost like I'm saying nepotism, but I'm not. I'm just saying that some of the casting, and I suppose because especially back in the 20th century, the BBC was especially, well, no, all of it, because he was on ITV as well, was kind of a quite close-knit. So it'd be quite easy to sort of cross paths with other members if you're in this sort of similar troupe of drama.
Well, I suppose so. Michael Troughton was, this is back in the 90s. Michael Troughton was also on telly a lot during the 90s.
Yes, he was, yeah.
It is written in blood, just to clarify that. So, and I've read the book. There's an interesting thing about this. There's only like 6 or 7 books by Caroline Graham, and yet there's obviously 100 and whatever episodes of Midsummer Murders that they've managed to draw from these books. And I think this one of the others, and the first one, Killing at Badger's Drift, are the closest to the actual original text. But the reason I started with this was because you can obviously, as you can with anything, you can watch stuff on ITVX or BritBox or Netflix or Amazon Prime, whatever. You told me the other day, didn't you, that The Sweeney's on Amazon Prime. And, of course, a lot of classic TV is available on DVD and Blu-ray. And up until recently, there was a company called Network On Air, also known as just Network, who have sadly ceased to be, which has become as a bit of a surprise to a lot of people, because they, only a couple of months ago, earlier this year in 2023, they released a vast, and I mean vast, collection of Crossroads DVDs.
They produce the material, as their catalogue is their own, they buy the license and
they license the material, yeah, they license the material. Right. And then they issue it on DVD. Often there's extras in there and so forth. Over the years, I've bought a few from them. There's a whole load of them on my shelf. There's some Tommy Cooper, some Les Dawson, there's Joker's Wild, a number of other things that I can't see because I've got a ornament in the way. It's actually a teleprompter mirror. But you get the drift. Now, Network On Air, until very recently, were operating and listing stuff for sale. I mean, I was on there a couple of weeks ago. So this is a very sudden, and apparently without any real warning, thing that happened. And as I say, there's a Crossroads box set, among many other things. Now, it was reported on Twitter by Richard Marson, the filmmaker, writer, who says, so sorry to hear of the sudden demise of Network Tweets, which was their Twitter account, which has provided an incredible service over many years for fans of vintage British TV and film. It is truly the end of an era of the steady liberation of eclectic niche material from archives. And, you know, there was a lot of very unusual material on the surface. I've mentioned Crossroads, but, you know, there's obscure sitcoms, forgotten from the 90s, and 80s and 70s and 60s, maybe even 50s and beyond, old movies, all sorts of material were available to buy on DVD and Blu-ray. Blu-ray, beg your pardon. It reminded me of the closure of Borders about 15 years ago when they went bust, because they had another place that had a big collection of DVDs and books and imported magazines and comics and things. You could just go in and browse and maybe not come out for the rest of the day. And
so as I'm here, sitting here pensively stirring my chocolate milk with my finger.
Ew.
What's your take on this? Because, I mean, I'm sure the listener as well is listening, because I'm very much a listener in this as well.
And
what's your take on this so far? What's your line on it? Because this is obviously quite a sudden thing. And as you say, for people like yourself, you know, middle-aged men with too much money to spare, it's clearly a space that you like to sort of wander and sort of pull on your flannel shirt and, you know, I can't remember what other people of your generation would wear.
Well, I mean, we were literally born weeks apart, but yeah, cool, we'll go with it.
But what do you think the significance of this is?
Hang on, do you have a flannel shirt? Because I don't have a flannel shirt.
Flannel was the 90s thing. Flannel was a kind of big thing at the time.
Yeah, I missed that. It was all metal T-shirts when I was in the 90s.
Well, yeah, it was metal with flannel. That was a kind of grunge look. Get with it.
Yeah, okay. So, it is a big thing. I mean, I bought loads of professionals' Blu-ray reissues, which were all beautifully remastered with the original film, and you've never seen a professional's episode look that good unless it happens to be one that you've seen on TV. It's from those remastered Blu-rays. You know, in the old days, it never looked that good. It looked all muddy and grainy and whatever. And I think that, you know, the fact that this vast catalogue of largely remastered material, or certainly, alternatively, I should say, material that's been released for the first time, the fact that you can't even browse the index anymore is a It's kind of hurts a little bit. It's like there's like a big portion of the internet has been withdrawn from life. Now, networkonair.com diverts to an account suspended page. However, I should add that support.networkonair.com is operational, and it is providing answers to questions. Although, I should just double check this. I don't think there are any specific questions about what's happened to the website, although there are, I could be wrong on that, there are a lot of articles on there for this, but there are things to do with international delivery delays, UK delivery delays and things like that. So, I mean, if you have got an order, it's probably gone missing, though. It's probably gone. It's difficult to say.
So you think that's more of like a support page to kind of round off any...
Yeah, partially.
Existing, yeah.
Yeah, partially, because, most of these pages haven't been updated in some time. And as I say, I don't seem to be able to find anything new on there. And it might be contractual anyway. Now, there is also a service called watch.networkonair. Now, I believe, certainly up until a couple of days ago, that was still operational. And it is still there. So if you have a subscription with their streaming service, you can still watch Dial 999, Casebook 1, Callan, Armchair Theatre, any number of very niche and eclectic and, you know, things that nobody's even thought of for a second time since the 1940s or at any time since. It's an insane collection of things hosted there.
You normally come to your argument with a bit of a punch here, and I feel like I'm still waiting to hear what you think this means in terms of almost like either two cultures or a topicality. You know, is it about, and I'm be clear to the listener here, I'm not criticising my colleague here at all. I'm just sort of trying to unravel it a bit as a listener. It's like my brain's going like, you know, kind of, what does this sort of say? Is it that, you know, is it something about how, you know, we kind of get almost complacent with a sort of permanence of material that we've got at the moment, and there is that shock, or is it something more specific about, you know, we undervalue, it's kind of like an undervalued area of our culture, which is a kind of thing where you're going here, is, you know, because the DVDs weren't just like, you know, a streaming catalogue where you have the show and pretty much nothing else, maybe a couple of tidbits that Prime steals from its IMDb database. But there is something kind of culturally significant that is almost lost, and yet no one's really noticed it or really commented about it.
That
feels like where you're at.
It does to me. The weird thing about it, because obviously, you know, things have happened over the past few years, and people's incomes have changed and what have you. Mm. That has possibly had an impact on it. Mm. But at the same time, this is a site that provides such a wide yet narrow... I know what I'm saying. Collection of things that a wide collection of things that are far off the beaten path, let's say.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's things on here that are never going to see the light of day on ITVX or BritBox. And there is certainly an argument that streaming services, particularly those two, and maybe some of what BBC is doing with iPlayer recently, have perhaps caused some difficulties there. But, you know, there's been very little detail about Network on there. Since it closed, there isn't really anything. There's rumours that the stock has been picked up and is going to be sold by another company, but that's pretty much it as things go. Do I think streaming is to blame? I don't know. I mean,
I wasn't trying to suggest that's what you were arguing here.
No, that was me.
Okay, cool.
And but I mean, you know, it's almost the immediate response to something like this, isn't it? You think, oh, there's another TV network gone, you know, it's bloody streaming.
Is it, to go back to flannel, is it age? Because the sort of demographic who would be looking to tap into this sort of type of rare nostalgia, in part because the way stuff was archived, the way stuff was licensed was kind of different. So it's sort of... the preciousness, its uniqueness, its scarcity is perhaps more of a generation that sort of people, especially in terms of physical collecting, is getting less for various reasons. I mean, it could be, you know, the nihilistic, you know, that people pass away as they get older, who would have been watching the stuff in the 60s and the 70s as sort of adults, or, you know, coming up to middle age, or, you know, younger, scarily. And that market is dwindling. Is it that, as you say, compounded with obviously cost of living might mean that even those people in that group might be less inclined to spend, or obviously it could be something internal, or cost of living actually affecting companies which are producing, as you say, quite unusual brand of goods, which you can't just simply create. You've got to get licensed, negotiate, create extra material for, or get extra material made for. And that's just not as sustainable.
It could entirely be that. I'm absolutely certain that there are numerous factors that have contributed to this. And many more that we haven't even touched on. Some of the things you will find in other places, they sell through Amazon, for instance. So, I mean, maybe it's a better idea to just sell through Amazon than it is to have your own site. I've just looked up Crown Court Volume 1, which, you know, you can buy for £15.49. It has a number of guest stars. I think one of them might be Joanna Lumley. One of them's definitely Ian Marta. And that's $15.49 on Amazon, published by Network. So, you know, they are, their material is still out there that they've published. It is still out there and available to buy, because this one came out years ago. But so it's not like they've completely gone, and I suppose they've left their mark in a way. So that's not, I mean, that's something to be proud of, I suppose. It's just a shame the site's gone.
I mean, again, it's that sort of thing about it's not, I mean, they've left their mark, which is good, but it's almost, again, that whole thing of, I just wonder whether there's a broader ripple here in terms of, a broader emotional ripple in terms of looking back at or enjoying consuming older material. Is that you, it feels the gateway closes a little bit with each generation, because you're going to get less and less people of younger generations who are going to even, well, they won't have the nostalgia for it because they won't have experienced it the first time, or, you know, even experienced it as a small kid and being something that their parents watched. And so it's sort of need to have that level of detail, that level of special material that, that the people who want to buy that would want to engage with just isn't there.
Yeah.
So in a sense, there's a kind of sadness, which I think is less about the sort of commercial question of why this thing failed, but the fact that we, it's almost emblematic of how generations and how material changes as the people, as that generation becomes less and less and becomes less important, less relevant, except for perhaps researchers and archivists. And that's kind of sad, I suppose. It's sad to think that that's all mattering less. And, you know, one of the big things I think that, that kills it, because, you know, I'm, as you say, I, you know, I'm close to your age, I suppose, that, you know, I don't watch my DVDs anymore because, quite frankly, I've not got round to buying another DVD player because, you know, as we know, towers no longer have them as part of their, you know, default.
I didn't know that.
Selling point.
I haven't bought a DVD PC tower in a long time.
No, yeah, you won't get one on a PC tower. You won't get one on a laptop, notebook.
No.
You know, obviously tablets, haha. So you're actually losing those sort of ways to actually have a product which people, even of that generation, might have the player left to use.
Well, you can use a game console, should you have one.
Yeah, well, I mean, I use my PC. I got rid of my old game console, which was my other way. I do have a very old laptop, which I can use. I do have a TV, an old TV in my bedroom, which has a has an inbuilt DVD player on the side. But that's kind of what I mean, that, you know, because the DVD is itself, and to some degree the Blu-ray a little bit, is becoming itself an older format of data storage, it becomes harder to market. And it's like, I think the weird thing is, as we go into this and perhaps making it into a, and the topic starts to unfurl as we talk, is that root of what made the DVD so special over the video was, as you noted, was suddenly when we saw what extra material could be loaded onto a DVD that couldn't really be on a video. I mean, like, I think, as we've said before, I remember the first commentary I heard was Usual Suspects, which was on a double video VHS set, and that was how they did it. So to have this as I say, this data storage which and data delivery device that could not just show you the film, but also sort of give you a sort of an immersion of the things around the film at different levels of content, depending on what you got, you know, and what was licensed. It's very hard to replicate that outside of that medium on what we tend to use now, which is, as we know, is streaming services. And some would argue you don't need it because you've got YouTube, which will have a lot of stuff around a show or a film you can just find. And IMDb has a lot of that sort of little nuanced trivia, but not on some of the, not on the nuanced things that kind of you're talking about, because those are kind of specialists. So finding that sort of stuff's less, and you would rely on a DVD release where that that product will have had some ability, hopefully, or had some money behind it to access some of the material there, which otherwise would be hard to get hold of, and place it in a space, you know, in a space which you could access. So once you lose the DVD, and let's say Blu-ray, which has always been, you know, the shinier cousin, you kind of lose that that model of, you know, experiencing a text, you know, your content, not just the film, but the things which made meaning of the film. I mean, if we go back to Doctor Who, as I don't know why we would, but you know, those BBC DVDs, you know, they would be filled with things like, you know, idents and trailers and stuff of the time,
because Blue Peter.
Blue Peter, yeah. So they'll be tapping into an audience that wants to sort of not just watch the show, but wants to kind of teleport, time travel, whatever you want to call it, back to that period and feel what it was like to sort of experience, you know. And now on BBC One, you know, or after the news, or, you know, after Question of Sport, Blake 7, you know, that sort of feeling. And there isn't really a service which does that digitally, you know, online catalogue, or hasn't, as far as I'm aware.
It would be nice, wouldn't it, if BritBox, for example, or iPlayer, but we'll stay with BritBox because they have Doctor Who as an example, the one that we're using, if they had an option. Because I believe some extras, if they're not on BritBox, they have been on BritBox. But it would be nice if you could, you know, configure a Doctor Who story on BritBox, or just like clicking a couple of tick boxes to include the announcer talking over the titles, for example.
Yeah, I agree. But I suppose is part of this, again, if we look at where we are now, that nuance or that extra data for a lot of people of all ages is not unwelcome, but not needed, because beyond the actual show, unless they have that sort of nostalgic engagement, there's so many other things to see and to watch that you don't feel the need for it. You don't feel the need to have a DVD where you can plunder what will inevitably be some quite boring documentaries and some quite naff, you know, idents or whatever. You know, you go on to the next thing that you've got to watch. And we didn't have, when DVDs were sort of so filled with material, I know this again sounds old, but I mean, most people listening to this, I suspect, are over the age of 10. You know, even back into the 2000s, you still had, apart from Sky, as we've said before, everything was, you know, it was broadcast. So you couldn't just tap into anything at any time you wanted, unless it was on DVD. Mm. So you don't have that now, because if you want to tap into anything, the first thing you'll probably do is most people go to their TV set because they've got a button and just go through their catalogues rather than searching through their box sets, because it's just easier than having to open a box set, shove a DVD in, just press play and watch something you've not seen before in something that an algorithm has told is probably something you'd like.
Yeah. I recall my dad, I mean, he's not dead or anything, but when I was a child, he was very interested in getting hold of radio shows that the BBC were re-releasing or rebroadcasting. And I think in many ways, obviously radio and TV have run concurrently for most of their lifespan, and a lot of both has been lost. But my dad was very keen on hearing or reliving or re-experiencing. And, you know, I feel like it's a little bit like me at the moment with my collecting of retro games. He wanted to. There's a series called Journey into Space that was on BBC Radio, which was a dramatised space exploration show. I think David Jacobs, in his acting days before he became a presenter, he was in it. Obviously, long since passed. But my dad was also collecting very, very glossy and expensive reprints of the Dan Dare serials from The Eagle. He still got these reissues, and the original comics binned when he left home back in the 60s, you know. So maybe just to take this to a slightly different angle, maybe we feel that this is very much an our generation thing, but I suspect people of my father's generation, you know, if they'd had the same opportunity to open, I mean, you know, they did, really, didn't they? They did have the same opportunities. They bought DVDs full of extras. My dad's collection of westerns on DVD and Blu-ray is quite something. So, but we do tend to consider this to be a very kind of like an our generation thing to do, whereas You know, there are other generations who have sort of bought into this kind of nostalgic re-release DVD interest, extras. You know, I'm pretty sure my dad's bought stuff from Network anyway. So
yeah, but again, being quite close to your dad's age, we've got that thing, haven't we? That they are led by the same drive as Gen X. And millennials as well, to some degree, depending on where you are on that spectrum of dates, where you're picking up things because you, for a while, you couldn't relive them, and now you have the opportunity to have them.
Yeah.
So they become special through that scarcity. But when you live in a world where much of the material, which has a lot of meaning, is quite easily available, that becomes a different thing. Now, I should stress here that I'm not saying that means that sort of late millennial Gen Z don't do this, because I think that would be, again, a sort of a big assumption. Some do. And you'll find people of those generations as well who will look back to, say, like the children's shows that they would have seen in the 2000s, which understandably aren't particularly archived either. And for them too, there'll be this feeling of wanting to know more about that show, because it had a lot of meaning for them when they were a child. And not didn't really have any meaning to adults, so therefore adults not really developed any archives or data or exploration of what this show was. So I think that curiosity still exists. I think, as I say, it's tapered a little by the amount of things to consume, which I think lowers the sort of preciousness of stuff, because it's just so much out there, and what is big in a big way. You know, we thought Star Wars was big when we were kids. You know, Star Wars is big now, because multiple shows, multiple merchandise aimed at multiple demographics. Everything is so bigger. But then maybe come 10 years down the line, maybe that will become kind of still become a thing. Because again, we probably always do look back, and there'll be people who will look back at that time when there was, you know, the kickoff of the Marvel era or the kickoff of the Star Wars era, new Star Wars era, and, you know, what that sort of in their memory was special to them by things which were possibly physical or, as you say, you know, with your interest in retro games. Yeah, because games, as we know, maybe a listener hasn't really thought about this too much, because why would you? You've got other things to do. But games are an extremely ephemeral medium, because they are constantly linked to the way that they are actually distributed, which is console generations or computer generations, which have a quite short shelf life before they disappear. So unless you're using images or other ways to actually, or there are reissued devices to allow you to play these things, they have very short shelf lives. So that would be something I could imagine in 10 years time, if we're all still here, then that would be something that might have that same sort of engagement, you know. And maybe that's kind of where another form of box set will become, you know, when you can relive and play these games with all the material that came out. I don't know.
Well, we're kind of in that period now in some ways. There are companies that do special editions, special edition re-releases of specific games. There's limited run games and strictly limited games in particular that I can think of, that re-release games from the 16-bit era particularly on PlayStation 4 and Nintendo Switch mainly, and they will release, you can get like a vanilla copy, and you get like a compilation. For instance, Turrican, which was a great game on the Amiga, sort of Metroidvania shoot 'em up.
Probably.
That in particular has been re-released on Nintendo Switch. I've got the vanilla version of that, but there are other editions where you get sort of like beautiful, great big artwork from the box and key rings. Obviously, you didn't get soundtrack discs, things like that. So, this happens for a number of games from that era. Now, it's happening now.
Yeah, and it will. And I think the only thing that changes to some degree is obviously the mode of how you can access that data.
Yeah.
And as you say, what are those engagements? What are those interests? Where is the nostalgia coming from for you to want to grab that stuff? But I think it is interesting when sort of 90s onwards, so much data around cult material has been so heavily mined. It's interesting. You think of like, well, where's the shelf life on some of those bigger things? You know, how many things can you reissue and find new stuff. But I think video games, to this day, still are an industry which largely the behind, you know, the background to them, I don't get the feeling, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, is quite so heavily tapped as obviously television and film.
I think it clearly has the potential to be, and arguably it is arguably easier when you have certain sort of core elements of a game that can be repurposed. So in some ways it's easier. And obviously, if you're going to start from scratch, then that will not be the point at all. But something that comes to mind in particular is the series Half-Life, which first came out in the late 90s, and then Half-Life 2 came 2003-2004 sort of time. There's been various remakes of these games. There's one called Black Mesa, which remakes the original game with the modern environment, this modern Source engine. Just recently, there's been a game called Project Loop, which is available as a demo on ModDB, and it is a version of Half-Life's first level, I think. But, and this is the key thing, it is a side-scrolling twin controller sort of, not a platform, you know, like a side-scrolling explorer shooter, sort of like, you know, point the mouse at the target and click sort of a game. Whereas the original game's a first-person shooter. So, you know, it's a complete respin of the same game. Now, this has been done by a modder, although it's been approved by the publisher. So a lot of this does tend to happen with, you know, all these new levels and maps and things from modders do tend to do this more than the real owners, the IP holders. Doom is another example of this, which has got a massive collection of maps and mods.
But that, again, is another reason why we can separate out and sort of say how people will and how people do engage with video games as a media form is different in some degree, because the ways to sort of engage with it and your love of it can be through, it's easier to rebuild it. You know, you can mod or you can rebuild a game if you have that skill set to rebuild Blake 7. Mm-hmm. Requires a very different set of skills, money, space, and obviously some degree license, depending on, again, as you say, whether parent companies are happy with this, with the sort of approach here. But in a weird way, with video games, because there's so much more sort of activity in there, so much about the play, it feels like it's almost like to re-explore a certain video game from the past is almost to reinvent it or to revisit and rebuild it or to experience the game, while so much around, if we go back to the DVD, is about sort of unearthing, keeping what you liked pristine and sort of going underneath that and sort of going, what was it be underneath there? What happened? You know, what was the genesis of this? How did it grow? You know, how did people talk about it? What, you know, how did the cast work, how was the show promoted? And I'm not for a moment saying that also doesn't happen with video games. Certainly in research into video games it does, but also in you know, fans will do that too to some degree. But I just wonder whether that, because like you say, you know, some people want to play the video game as close to their original experience as possible. So it's not, I'm not saying for a moment video game people don't have that desire to keep that bit pristine, but I just wonder whether there is the way that we can engage in those mediums changes and how we sort of celebrate them, maybe. Because that's kind of what we do when we buy a DVD of something that we once loved. We don't go and buy a DVD of something we hated. It's kind of a celebration. It's like, I want to rewatch this and enjoy it and see if it's still cool, or it is still cool and I want to rewatch it and have pleasure from it. So it's always a celebration, but how we celebrate between, say, film and television, video games, kind of different. I don't know, maybe. Massive assumptions being made here.
Yes.
I'm sure the reader could write some very angry letters if he was from 1986. But we don't write letters anymore, do we, reader from 1986?
I don't know. I'm writing this cross email to the school in the morning, but I suppose...
Email? So not a letter?
It has to go as an email, though, unfortunately, because it has an attachment. That's what I'm
saying. So the angry letter is just, you know, the hard cursive handwriting and the angry full stop, and it's just not...
When did people start saying cursive instead of joined up? When did that happen?
I wonder if that was partially to do with, I was going to say, the movement into internet, word processing. And not that I'm not, for a minute, again, just to make sure, I'm not saying cursive didn't exist as a word before that. I'm just saying, yeah, as you're saying, when did it sort of become really part of the lexicon that we, or the language? I don't know.
It's like it happened one day and no one had told me. And
I suppose because cursive almost sounds like something where you're referring to something, and again, it's not always, something which was done. Well, joined up writing sounds like something we do every day. It feels like you're talking about an everyday activity because it doesn't have that sort of sense of formality, that formalness. You don't think of whether it's in caps or uppercase or lowercase, which again, I think has come largely from keyboards and computers.
Yeah.
We think about it as we used to think about it as a joined up writing or capital letters. I don't know.
No, I don't
know. The past is a scary thing. I tend to, despite the way this podcast has pressured me to do otherwise, think it's good to live in the present because the past always feels kind of, it lures you in with its sort of call to sort of memories and to experiences. But ultimately, it just pulls you onto the jagged rocks of realizing that time is gone and it's confusing because you kind of want to experience it again, but you can't. Mm. And then there's all those other things. And the future's scary as well. So, yeah, just stay in the moment. Just keep listening to the podcast because you're safe here.
Well, possibly. I might be about to throw it all open, though. You were referring to various social generations earlier, and
I was
getting a little confused as to which ones were which. It turns out
most people.
Yeah, well, it turns out I'm married to a millennial. I didn't know that. That's come as a bit of a surprise. We're going to be having cross words later.
Yep.
And I know I'm Generation X because that's the best one, obviously. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say there is the sub-generationals as well, and you are in some spaces classed as a zennial.
No, I'm not.
You are in some are because the sort of 70s, back end of the 70s, sort of speaks to that sort of change in mentality and change in that sits with some of the experiences which millennials and zennials will have had. So for instance, like a Gen X born in 69 is very unlikely to have had that sort of early engagement with the 8-bit era that a zennial and certainly and to some degree but not perhaps as much a millennial might have had the back end of it if they were very born in 80 82 83 7 possibly. But so even in there there are these sort of sub groups, and I think they kind of were, because I think otherwise they're as ridiculous as saying what about the 80s, because if you look at the stars in 81 to 89, massively different. 10 years time to sort of to group everything. So
yeah,
I think things like zennials are quite good because they do acknowledge that it's not just about the period of time, it's about what's going on in those periods of time. But sorry.
Yeah. Anyway, and then I thought both my parents were boomers, but of course my dad was born in 1941, so he wouldn't be.
No.
Whereas my mum is. And so my father and I have the same the same gap between our partners. So my daddy's silent generation, which I thought was my grandma. But no, my grandma was a greatest generation because she was born in 1925. Now, the reason I only go that far back and not beyond to lost generation is because my gran passed away in 2016 and it took a lot of time to get her to watch a colour television. She had a black and white until, mid-90s. And I can't imagine her ever, she barely got to grips with a remote control. I can't imagine her ever sitting down to watch a DVD. She didn't enjoy repeats. She watched very little on television. If it was, horse races and Countdown and 15 to 1, shows like that is what she watched. I think she got sick of soap operas because they were repetitive. What calling back to what we were saying before about our generation and you obviously being around the same age as my dad, etc. Is there what's happened there? Why have people who were born in the first quarter of the 20th century, why do you think there's this less interest or decreased interest or even no interest in DVDs and extras? And
I think the answer is really obvious.
Okay.
And that's that they didn't grow up as children with television in some form.
Mm-hmm.
While to some degree your dad will have, not depending obviously on his experience, but I would say that the experience of television, the experience of the formative experience of it, probably is why it taps very heavily into sort of millennial, or so to say, Generation X, Xennial, and some millennial, and some, you know, and a bit either side, boomer as well to a degree, because there is a certain amount of that experience of growing up with that sort of material and sort of having some sort of connection to it. I think that's in part some of it. And maybe even for people of boomer generation, it could be having grown up, also had their kids and experienced their kids growing into that sort of space. And so thus television has a sort of meaning to them, which perhaps just isn't quite there for the silent generation. That doesn't have those landmarks so easily.
Mm.
I think that's probably what it is. Again, this is just off the top of my head, in the same way that it blows my mind. I don't understand how Countdown, I don't understand how that works. I'm talking about the Channel 4 show for those who are overseas.
Right.
Came out in 82, was it?
82, was 84. It the first show on Channel 4?
Yeah, Channel
it?
4, Channel 4, 82, 84. My brain gets totally mixed up on numbers. It was the first show on Channel 4. And it's basically a show where you have mixed up word, you choose a selection of words and you have to make a word out of those, that is a collection of letters within 60 seconds or 30 seconds. And the reason I bring it up is at the time when it came out, and again, this goes back to what we talk about with demographics, you know, that was very much situated as a show which quickly became something for an older generation. It was a very safe, gentle show and they played into that. And what I find fascinating is, as far as I'm aware, it's still going.
Yeah,
and as
yeah.
far as I'm aware, it still taps into that same generation. But we are now talking like 40 years of that. I mean, that generation can't still be there. So at some point, people who, you know, in the 80, you know, early 80s, and I should know when Channel 4, it's terrible, but my brain has problems sometimes with numbers. When Channel 4 existed, you know, they would have thought that was an old person show. And yet would now be, or an older person's show, and now might be the people who are actually watching that show. And I find that kind of scary.
Well, I mean, I'm like pretty sure yeah. it's the same people who watch, I'm going to reel off a load of shows which probably aren't on anymore, Ground Force and, oh God, I don't know what these shows are called. What's that one with David Dickinson, the bronze Total face? Like,
well, yeah, I mean, the bargain hunt genre.
Bargain hunt. Like,
but
yeah.
I mean, I would say that still has a far wider demographic space than I think Countdown does. Because I don't really think Countdown ever tapped into like student audiences.
Did
ever.
It not?
I don't really think so. Not okay. like I know Blockbusters did for a time in the 80s. Again, another UK show. But I think Bargain Hunt, because it was, because of its position as a sort of lunchtime, early afternoon, so it would tap a student market quite easily, while Countdown a little later might not so much. I mean, it wasn't late, but I think there's a difference in those sort of time periods for students. I don't think Countdown has ever really had the coolness it wanted, and that's kind of where the comedy quiz show 8 out of 9 Cats Does Countdown was kind of almost playing on that fact that it was so uncool that they could make it into a fun platform that, you know, they could, there was something odd about
not,
that.
Is it not 8 out of 10 Cats?
That's what I said.
You said 8 out of 9.
Did I? 8 out of 9? Did I not say a few minutes ago, I said I had a problem with numbers? Did I not say that? I think I did. It was a few minutes ago.
You
no,
did,
I said
my
a few,
apologies.
I didn't say 5 or 6 minutes ago because I get them the wrong way around, wouldn't I? I don't know. I don't know. But I just sometimes find it fascinating how we as generations grow into those generations and, like, you know, caterpillars to butterflies, or perhaps in this case, butterflies to caterpillars. We sort of, I mean, that was quite profound, actually.
Was.
That I find weird, you know. I can't understand when I see people around sometimes in town, I think, how have you become this generation? I've tried to fight it, and I can't totally fight it because, you know, we age. But how have you become your dad, you know, or your granddad? How has that happened? in down to the sort of stuff you might watch on television. That's crazy.
As we're talking about Countdown, if I was to say to you the word slob-lock,
yeah,
what would come to mind?
Well, I mean, obviously, because you know me, I would obviously be thinking you'd be referring to a bit of Fry and Laurie.
I would.
And the Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie send-up of Countdown.
Yes.
And Richard Whiteley in particular. Yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Yes, yes. Now, what I didn't know, because I just decided to Google the word slob-lock, Carol Vorderman called her house Slob-lock Hall.
Did she?
She did.
Ah, good honour. Good honour. But, you know, buy into that. Countdown's a really weird show. If you've never experienced Countdown, I don't know how it would land in, you know, if you come from a different country and you've never heard of it, or if you're young and listening to this and you've defied me and you're under 10. It's worth having a look because it's a fascinating show in terms of just its whole cultural heritage, what it does, because it is probably one of the most, and I mean this in a kind way, probably one of the most lame formats of a game show. Maybe I'm being cruel there, but I mean it literally is. There's three parts of it, and the third part is only at the very, very end, and it's like for 10 seconds.
Yeah,
you're doing the same thing over and over again. There's no feel of shift in format. There's deliberately no energy to it. Do you know what I mean? There's no crowd. There's no sort of, you know, obviously if we're talking to any American audiences out there, there's no feeling of a studio audience being whipped up to be excited about this. Everyone is very passive, very British. It's all very gentle. It's got a real sort of radio format to it.
Mm,
it says thinking it about it now in my head, and maybe that's kind of what they were trying to tap into, is whether, you know, was that an approach of trying to bring something radio onto television with Channel 4. I don't know, but this is again why it's interesting to find out this stuff, because it just gets lost, and I'm sure the Countdown DVD set would have all the nitty-gritty.
I'm just looking at the list of hosts of Countdown.
Yeah,
it's quite depressing reading actually, because you got Richard Whiteley.
Yes.
82 to 2005. Then you got Des Lynam for a year, Des O'Connor for a year. Des O'Connor once liked one of my tweets. Well, it might have been his wife, okay, but whatever. Jeff Stelling, who's local to me, 2009, 2011. Nick Hewer, 2012 to 2021. So he put in a shift. Anne Robinson turned up for a year. And then Colin Murray is the current presenter of Countdown, which I can't quite imagine because he's a bit kind of bit chipper for Countdown, I would have thought. And it's based on a show called Des Chiffres et des Libres, a lettre, I beg your pardon, which is called Numbers and Letters. A French television programme created by Armand Jamot in 1965.
I didn't know that. So it was a television show, a French television show prior, and
yeah,
the format was bought.
Yeah.
So it wasn't emulated, it was actually bought as a, okay, okay.
Yeah, piss, so
yeah. Well, I never knew that.
Neither did I.
And it's exactly why I'd have wasted my time buying a DVD set of Countdown when, as you have just done, I could find that stuff on the internet.
Yeah. Casterbus, where we produce DVD extras for Countdown.
Yeah. But, But, I mean, it's a fascinating thing. I mean, I wonder what... If Countdown had only existed for, like, 3 years and was kind of like a... almost like a latent memory for a lot of people growing up at that time, I wonder what sort of feelings and interest to see it there would be than obviously when it's been continual... you know, some of that magic and engagement gets lost because it comes sort of vaguely banal. You know, if you turn on Channel 4 at one point of the day, your heart will sink. So,
well, maybe, but then again, if it hadn't lasted very long, I doubt it will be remembered as fondly as, I'd pick up some really bad ideas now, Chain Letters or Bob's Full House, or actually Bob's Full House was quite good. There was one that hosted by Andrew O'Connor. That might have been Chain Letters, actually. Yeah, I think that was Chain Letters. Because there was that period, wasn't there, on ITV on a morning. There was like a new game show almost every week.
Oh, yeah.
If not, true. Unless they did different ones on different days and then carried them on the next week.
I mean, obviously... The famous one that if we were going to talk about, we'd have to be going for gold. Because
oh yeah.
I mean that was a format which I use your machine, find out something about that, because that show didn't make sense. That must have come from surely another country.
I'm pretty sure that was a pan-European show.
Because that would make sense, because it didn't make sense to do it here, because we have such a localized language that it just meant every other contestant from another country kind of felt like they were off-footed by the fact that you had someone fluent in their second language who would be on there. And would, strangely enough, always lose as well. England would tend to lose going for gold.
We'd be completely wrong in this assumption.
Fine.
Going for gold, says Wikipedia, began its life as an American pilot, Run for the Money, hosted by Bill Rafferty, produced for ABC in 1987 and not picked up. So the producer, Grundy, is that Rich?
Yep, Grundy, for same neighbours, wasn't it?
Grundy. Yeah, so Grundy took to Europe. There were other versions of it, but no, the one that was on the BBC was the only one, and then it was screened across Europe.
It's so curious, because it was such a ridiculous format. I mean, it would have been okay if maybe we had a feeling that the questions were being asked to the people, because I mean, for those who don't know, Going for Gold was basically playing on a championship of gold medal, where you'd have various contestants from different countries competing in a quiz show, but all the questions were asked in English, and all the people from other countries would be again. So it'd always be an England person there as well who could speak English fluently, and they were often timed. It was buzz in as well, I think. So it always felt really weird. A weird show. So unless there was something like behind the scenes where the questions were fed in a first language to contestants from different countries, I don't know. But watching it just felt such a really weirdly weighted show in terms of fairness.
Well, the questions are a little. I mean, it's one of those things that the Pythons predicted. There's the communist quiz, where there's these questions about communism that are given to all these communists, Mao Zedong and Karl Marx, etc., etc. And then the final question to win the star prize starts off with the hammers. You think, it's another question about communism. The hammers is a nickname of which English football team?
Yeah,
and he completely throws. I think I can't remember who it is.
Because Going for Gold, in a weird way, and again, this could be my memory as much as yours of it, because it was made. I mean, I know, as you say, it went overseas, but obviously, it was primarily made for a British audience in the way.
Yeah,
that, you had Henry Kelly, who was very well known to British audiences from Game for a Laugh and the like. Running it. So it was obviously primarily made for British people with the possibility of it being sold elsewhere. So you always felt that the questions were slightly slanted towards stuff that the audience of Britain would know, which again defeated the entire point of the whole game show.
Yeah, they filmed at Television Centre and Elstree, so that would make sense. You're not going to give bring in an audience and give them questions about things that they know nothing about, are you?
Exactly. So it was just such a flawed idea, flawed method. And it makes me wonder if it was, when it was pitched in the States, wonder if it would have been states that would have been played off each other.
Well, that's the interesting thing about Going for Gold as well, isn't it? Because it started in 1987, it ran to 1996. But I mean, I would argue that's probably the period where in the UK, and James probably sort of smiled inwardly at my thoughts on this, period of the UK where the country generally was most favourable to being a member of a European community.
Yeah, it did feed into that, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It totally did.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that certainly helped its popularity.
I agree. I mean, you've thrown me with that because I'm just thinking about the whole context, but I mean, back at the point where Going for Gold was going, do you have actually years? What years it ran?
87. The original Henry Kelly run was 87 to 96.
87 to 96.
Yeah, then there was another series with John Suchet in 2008 to 2009.
Yeah, I mean, you got to the back end of the 80s where there's a fatigue of, you know, global tensions. You've got, you know, you're moving further and further away from Second World War, which obviously still had generations of. Tensions that were still being played out in
87 is around the time when the Labour Party decided that they actually wanted to be part of the European community as well, and they made that a policy because up to that point it was kind of split on the matter. You've also got the fall of communism in Eastern Europe slowly
coming up,
happening.
Yeah, that was coming up. So well, during that period, yeah. So I think there was this kind of like a revitalization in terms of, as you say, this or revitalization or a growing engagement on this idea of Europe at the time, which I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I was, you know, if I said, oh, we're part of Europe, people go, no, Europe's over there. So there's still that feeling in the 80s of that. And that was slightly shifting by that point. Mm. And while obviously I wouldn't even for a moment say that Going for Gold had any part in fostering that, it kind of played off what was shifting culturally into people being a little more aware of what Europe was and maybe, you know.
Definitely. It was optimistic.
Yeah, ability to travel was perhaps growing a little bit, but not obviously to the point where in the 90s it really kicked off with low-budget airlines, but it was moving in that direction of affordability too. So, yeah, I, again, it's just, it's funny, isn't it, when you know people will laugh at things like Going for Gold for good reason, because it was terrible. But it does, when you look at it and situate it in terms of what was going on around it, it becomes a really interesting moment, a marker of kind of what was in the sensibilities. Because you're right. I mean, and again, not waxing political, I think it would be quite difficult even at the moment, but certainly over the last few years, to have on the BBC a show which celebrated, you know, England or Britain within a sort of European context. So you can only do that when there is a space to do that. Mm. And like you say, at that kind of point, that's where the country, you know, was was at,
yeah,
pretty much collectively. So, yeah, and Going for Gold is interesting because, as I say, you couldn't at the moment do that. Maybe you could in a few years, but certainly it would be a very political tense thing to do. So, yeah, no, it's an interesting one. But, yeah, it was terrible. And the prize was always the same. It was always Mauritius. Never changed. Never changed.
I don't remember that. But sure, I do remember something. We referred to Fry and Laurie earlier, and I'm pretty sure they did some sort of sketch. I mean, I say pretty sure. They did a sketch of alternative swear words, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Mary Whitehouse Experience did something similar where they were using particular terms that were very along the same sort of lines. High-level swear words that people can't detect, right, essentially. But there was one in particular. And I remember this because I'm pretty sure it was on the radio before it was on the TV version of the Mary Whitehouse Experience. David Baddiel describing Henry Kelly as a Henry Kelly. Now, I mention this particularly because in the Wikipedia page for Going for Gold, David Baddiel has a Going for Gold winner's trophy despite not even appearing on the show.
Huh.
So did he get a Going for Gold winner's trophy for calling Henry Kelly a Henry Kelly?
I know. It's one of those sort of things where it's part of a cultural moment which, you know, goes on by. And I think, you know, this whole topic, if we were to sort of try in some desperate approach to tie into some theme or point, it still feels a bit like that sort of realization when you're sort of looking at the DVDs, going back to the to the DVD store,
yeah,
is that nothing is sacred, nothing stays, and that's part of why I think is again it's scarcity that draws us into sort of wanting to consume these things and see them and understand them, because we kind of know deep down that it's all ephemeral, that it's all just going to vanish. And we're just trying to stop that from happening. And when you see outlets like, as you say, close, it's just a reminder that all that stuff eventually, as we all will be, is gone. And again, if you go to archives, especially film archives, you really feel this because you'll see, you know, tape. You'll see spools all kept at you know certain temperatures to stop it from degrading and keeping it, but you know that's only going to stay like that as long as those facilities stay going, and that's purely dependent on power and electricity, and that's only stopping them from degrading. It's not stopping them, it's just slowing that. Everything has a point where it's just no longer going to be. And I suppose, yeah, and especially with the internet, we kind of get used to feeling like, well, everything's kind of going to be around forever, and it won't.
No.
And everything is even ephemeral in terms of, I think we said this the other day, you know, imagining it, you know, imagining it, I think, you know, imagining a time when, you know, thinking that Nintendo wouldn't be the big player, or, you know, even Sony to a degree, you know, or Blockbuster, or, yeah, and obviously we could probably in the last few years riff the same things in politics, where on either side of the spectrum, you would never imagine a time when that person wouldn't be there, and, you know, things move on. We get so used to feeling like the way things are cannot change, and they do.
All the time.
As we've said before, you know, 2013, you know, we've only had 10 years of streaming. Yeah. And already I'm starting to feel there's a fatigue there in terms of, as we were saying in passing the other day, you know, it's all, we can feel it changing. It's unsustainable as it is. We're seeing Netflix slowly realizing this in the way that we've seen before. Companies too slowly realize their predicament and not respond to it in an effective way, which becomes dangerous in terms of their market lead. And we could see this coming a mile off, but it's hard to imagine, you know, where we would go from here. It's not hard to imagine now Netflix losing its you know, its power position. It already has, I think. If you think back 6-7 years, Netflix yep. was, you know, dominant. It held the market with, you know, Sky fighting, now TV in the UK pushing a bit, which are connected, and, you know, Amazon Prime perhaps. Now it's a crowded market. And more that are available on our sort of terrestrial streams, catalogues. Not terrestrial, our digital catalogues, should I say. ITVX, as you said, and Channel yep. 4's got a massive catalogue. How is it going to go? I have no idea. It's not going to go back to DVDs. As much as some people like to laud at the moment, oh, the streamers are stopping you from seeing X. I've got my DVDs all on my shelf. And I was thinking, when I've read people saying that, yeah, I bet if you try and play half of those DVDs, you'll start seeing degradations, because those DVDs aren't meant to last either. You know, if they're over 15 years old, you could potentially start seeing problems there.
Yeah, CDs, there is such definitely. A thing as disc rot. Although, yeah. I mean, happily, I've been digging out some archive 5 1/4-inch discs over the past few months, and I was happy to report that they all played. Magnetic, of course, not optical, but even so.
I've seen my CD, what's left of my CD collections, pretty degrading now in some cases. Not across the board, but no. Yeah, and same with DVDs. So, yeah, you could be a proud owner of 33% that might not work properly on your machine anymore, because it's not a stable medium. It's not going to hold on forever.
So we probably need to wrap things up a little.
A little, you think just a little, I think, quite substantially.
Well, at least consider some paper for the wrapping up, maybe choose some tape. Obviously, Network On Air is gone. It might be picked up. Its stock might be picked up, beg your pardon. If you have a subscription to its streaming service, that is still going on. So you're quite fortunate with that. The wider conversation is DVDs are going to die. And,
definitely.
Streaming services appear to be at a strange crossroads, which, I mean, in some ways they've never really got a foothold, have they, in the same way, say, television, radio and newspapers did. They haven't really been able to solidify their position. So it's going to be quite interesting what happens next. Will they continue on their own? Will they merge? Will they be swallowed up by an existing broadcast giant? It is yet to be seen. If there's anything that we mentioned that's worth linking to in the show, I will add it to the show notes. Thank you very much for listening, and we will speak to you again soon. Pip, pip.